is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're here today for our third case, 01-3014, Linda Rolli Giovanni versus Paul Albert Baumgart. Representing Linda Rolli Giovanni is Linda Robeson. Ms. Robeson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Linda Robeson, and I am here today representing Linda Rolli Giovanni. Lynn is precisely the sort of person whom our divorce law was designed to protect. The trial court, in its 1990 decision in the divorce...
Ms. Robeson, I'm sorry. Our sound system is in a temporary status. It has been, unfortunately, such for a long time. We're getting feedback from you, and I don't know that there's anything we can do about that at the moment, but in light of the feedback, what you're going to have to do is try and speak slowly, so we hear you clearly two times.
I'm sorry. I moved the microphone down a little bit. Does that help at
that's
all?
That's helping now, but... Okay. It's not your fault. There's a problem here. Okay.
The trial court in the 1990 divorce action found that Lynn was entitled to the protection of indefinite maintenance because her contributions to her family during this long-term marriage, quote, permanently affected her earning capacity, end quote. A decade later, despite her continued contribution to the family and to Paul's increased earning capacity, as the virtually sole parent of the party's four children, a different trial court modified the original judgment to a limited term award, which terminated this past December, essentially overruling the initial trial court's determination that Lynn was entitled to the protection of indefinite maintenance. The Court of Appeals majority affirmed, ignoring this court's holding in LaRocque and in Hefty, and applying the wrong rule of law. I ask this court today to do three things, and I believe that the respondent agrees with two of them. First, I ask this court to clarify that a modification of maintenance requires more than a substantial change in circumstances. To clarify that that change in circumstances must be such that it would be unjust or inequitable to hold either party to the original maintenance award. This court used that standard in its decision in Phobes back in 1985. The Court of Appeals has subsequently applied this standard in Rossbrock and in Dahlke, a 2002 decision of the Court of Appeals, with regard to which this court did not grant review in 2003.
One of the points in the Court of Appeals decision is there's a line in there that says the cases can't easily be lined up and if they're not all clear, et cetera. Many of those cases are Court of Appeals cases, as I understand it. And do you think they can be lined up? Because I'm looking at infamous footnote one. Where there seem to be, at least if I understand your contention, that there are two standards, one unjust or inequitable, and the other, the substantial change must relate to a change in the financial circumstances. You view that as two different criteria?
Your Honor, I am as confused by the real meaning of footnote number one as anyone. I believe that in looking at the cases that the Court of Appeals cited in footnote number one, going back and looking at those cases, Our courts have not previously distinguished between stipulated and unstipulated, between limited term and indefinite term. In fact, the Court of Appeals takes this case back to the Minor case, which was a 1960 case, before
under the old statute.
Yes, before the Divorce Reform Act was passed. And that case is, according to the Court of Appeals, the genesis of the unjust and inequitable standard, which then was carried forward and used in cases pretty much consistently from 1960 to date. The Minor case did involve an indefinite term maintenance award. So I think in this footnote, the Court of Appeals is trying to distinguish on the one hand between limited term and indefinite term awards, and I think it's trying to distinguish on the other hand between stipulated and initially contested awards. But I don't think the case law lines up clearly to support that position in either direction, and I frankly am not sure what standard the Court of Appeals is trying to apply.
But you're suggesting it's unjust or inequitable.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that this Court has established that standard. I believe that the Court of Appeals has followed that standard in a number of cases, most recently in the Dahlke case, where there was an attempt to have this Court review the determination there, and this Court declined to do so.
Well, one of the questions I'm going to ask opposing counsel is what the standard he thinks is the correct one.
Our position, Your Honor, is that the same standard should apply to both stipulated and contested orders. The same standard should apply whether the order is for indefinite term or limited term maintenance. I believe this is the only way to give appropriate deference to the original trial court, that the original trial court's decision stands until one party can show that it would be unjust and inequitable to continue to apply that court's order because of changes in the party's circumstances.
Would that standard apply in all situations, for example, arbitral awards as well?
I believe it applies in all maintenance cases.
It would.
Would apply to any maintenance case. The respondent concedes this point in his brief to the court on page 30, and again in a long discussion on pages 40 through 42. In its analysis of this issue, I ask this court to clarify that the fairness objective applies in every maintenance case, withdrawing the language of Johnson 1 to the contrary. The respondent agrees with this as well, as he states on page 21 of his brief. And the Court of Appeals in this case also concluded that the fairness objective applies both to original determinations and to modifications of maintenance. The second thing that I ask this Court to do today is to look at the record with the appropriate allocation of the burden of proof to Paul, and in this light, to determine that he has not met his burden of demonstrating that continuing the maintenance award is unfair or inequitable to him, or that Lynn can attain or exceed the marital standard of living without continued maintenance. The Court of Appeals majority suggested that Lynn did not make her record in a number of places. I ask this Court to clarify that in the modification hearing, Lynn... Excuse me, I just lost my microphone.
Gives me time to catch up with the writing.
Sorry. Okay, now did I get this in an okay place so I'm not getting too much feedback? Good. I ask this court to clarify that in the modification hearing, Lynn was entitled to rely on the findings of fact made by the initial divorce court, which should stand unless or until Paul is able to demonstrate that they are no longer accurate. The respondent concedes on page 43 of his brief that deference to the initial court's findings of fact is appropriate. In this case, the Court of Appeals essentially assigned the burden of proof to Lynn to justify her continued need for maintenance. I believe that the law is clear that Paul bears this burden, and I would rely on Hauser and other subsequent cases to support that contention. The third thing that I ask this court to do is to hold that discretionary a parent's decision to use discretionary income to assist young adult children in obtaining their educations is as legitimate a use of funds as pursuing an expensive hobby, making charitable contributions, taking vacations, buying a nice wardrobe, or saving for the future, all of which prior case law has approved. This is not a child support issue. I think there's been some confusion about that throughout the history of this case, but it is not a child support issue. Rather, it is an issue that speaks to the propriety of the courts directing a maintenance recipient, or a maintenance payer for that matter, as to how he or she can spend the money available to him or her.
Well, I have a little trouble with this. When you're deciding whether to modify or even initiate a support order, you look at the income of each party, right?
Correct.
You look at the liabilities of each party.
Yes.
You look at the expenses of each party.
Yes.
And then, generally speaking, you make a fair allocation of these incomes based on concepts of support and fairness, if I understand your brief.
Yes.
Well, when you make expenses out, you put in your expenses. And I mean, it's quite easy on necessities, if we can agree on food and shelter and minimal clothing for warmth, okay, or coolness.
Yes.
After that, there are different degrees of luxuries.
Yes.
And somehow the court has to look at that to make an allocation, right?
Yes.
Between the parties. So they certainly can consider that there's child support, I should say adult support, right?
I believe that it's appropriate for the court to consider that a parent is assisting a young adult child in pursuing his or her educational goals.
Okay. And that's what you want, because you want them to take into account that she's spending $900 or so a month for an adult child.
As part of her discretionary spending.
Right. So the issue then is not how she spends it, but whether it's fair and needed that she have $900 discretionary spending. Is that your point?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in the context of this case, where Mr. Baumgart spends $250 a month on flying airplanes, spends a considerable amount on a wardrobe, saves $900 a month toward his retirement, there's clearly discretionary money here. By point in this case, I'm not asking that Lynn receive more support than she would otherwise be entitled to, more maintenance than she would otherwise be entitled to, because she chooses to spend some of it on her adult children. I am asking that she not be penalized because she has reduced her standard of living. She spends $50 a month on clothes. She's not saving the kind of money that a 50-year-old woman probably ought to be saving for retirement. She has chosen to put money into helping her children. And the result of the decisions below in this case is to say that she has to continue to have this much lower standard of living with respect to clothing, charitable contributions, savings, vacations, etc., all of which, if she had built them into her budget, would have been considered legitimate. She doesn't have those expensive things in her budget. She's spending money on her kids. And if you tell her she can't do that, I think there's a problem with the fairness objective of maintenance, because you are directing the recipient that she, in this case, must spend her money only in certain ways, where those constraints are not placed on the payer. I think that's a problem in terms of the fairness objective.
What part of the circuit court's order told her she couldn't spend her money that way?
Your Honor, are you referring to the initial trial court, or are you referring to the modification court?
I think we're looking at the modification court order here. That's what's on review.
Yes. And the modification court told her that she could not do that.
She couldn't spend her money that way?
I believe so. The modification court penalized her for spending money in that way.
How so?
Removed it from her budget.
Well, but it just said no more money after 2003. Is that what you're talking about?
The modification court said, and I don't remember the exact quote, but I think this is pretty close, she doesn't have a legal obligation to support the adult children's educational expenses. The child support law prohibits this, and so I can't look at this in reviewing her budget. And I think if she tightens her belt, she will be living reasonably comparable to the standard of living enjoyed during the marriage. Now, there are a number of things that are wrong with that analysis on the part of the modification court. One is that the arithmetic doesn't compute. Even if you take her budget and you subtract out the expenses for the children, she's still over $2,000 short of what was otherwise an undisputed budget. So there's a problem with just the arithmetic. Doing the math in terms of the facts that are in the record does not support that conclusion on the part of the trial court. But I would state further that it is not appropriate for a court to tell a parent, you can't help your kids get through college.
Well, that's what my question went to. There's nothing in the modification court's order that tells her she can't spend her money in the way that she sees fit. I think that overstates the matter.
What the modification court says is, the direct quote is, I'm not going to reward you on that regard.
What
that's,
page?
Page 187 of the transcript, it's B29 in our appendix in our brief in chief.
There's nothing in a maintenance award that emanates from a circuit court that tells anybody how to spend their money.
In this case, the circuit court penalized her for spending money in a way that the court felt was not appropriate. Did not consider this to be a legitimate part of her budget, treated the expenses that she was incurring on behalf of her adult children in a manner very differently from the way that same court looked at Paul's expenses for his hobbies, for his clothing, for his travel, for his retirement savings.
But as I read the trial court, and I thought this is what you were concerned about, the trial court here didn't just knock down her budget by $900. Trial court said, when you look at her needs, and take out the kids, when you look out at the needs, and you look at her income, she can do it on her own without maintenance after 2003. And that would be fair to both of them, and she's self-supporting. Therefore, we have stopped maintenance. Isn't that what he did?
That's correct, Your Honor. And what I am saying is that if her budget had included, instead of the $934 a month in expenses for the adult children, if she had spent that money the way Paul spent his discretionary money, the court would not have said you have to excise those things from your budget. There wouldn't have been any legal authority for the court to say you're not entitled to spend money on clothes, you're not entitled to have retirement savings, and so on.
And then what would the court have done, in your opinion? Said she's got to still have maintenance, it might be more, it might be less, but that you don't cut it off? Is that your point?
I believe that that is the response that the trial court would have had to have made, Your Honor, although I confess to being somewhat confused by the trial court's conclusion that taking out the children's expenses, she could meet her budget, when the arithmetic shows that she's still, I think, $2,800 a month short. And no one contested any other portion of her budget. The trial court didn't say, here are ways that you are spending money that you should not be spending money, except with respect to the expenses for the adult children. So the arithmetic doesn't work to support that analysis.
Your point is that she should have continued on in maintenance, and the arithmetic is wrong there, but it's an erroneous exercise of discretion.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Regardless of the children's support.
I believe that she is entitled to the amount of money that would allow her to live at the marital standard of living. I believe in this case the amount that is required to allow her to live at the marital standard of living is what is set forth in her undisputed budget. Another way, I suppose, to look at determining the marital standard of living would be to go back to the original divorce court's determination of what it took to meet the marital standard of living, subtract out the kids' expenses, and apply the stipulated cost of living multiplier to that amount. I think that this court said in LaRock and other cases that it really frowns on that kind of formulaic arithmetical approach to determining the marital standard of living, and that what you ought to do is look at people's actual expenses. But whichever way you do it, in this case, there is no way you can come up with a marital standard of living that she can meet from her income alone, even working two jobs. And I do not believe that the marital standard of living requires that this woman continue to work two jobs. I think the trial court in this case did not permit Lynn to, I'm sorry?
It's Justice Wilcox. You want
to
continue?
I think the trial court in this case did not permit Lynn the standard of living that she, that the original divorce court found that she was entitled to.
Let me ask you a question about the original divorce court and how you think that Judge Fiedler changed what Judge Steingass had done. When Judge Steingass granted indefinite maintenance, did she indicate that even if your client continued her education, got her master's degree, started making over $60,000 a year, that there shouldn't be any change in maintenance? Is that the kind of things that Judge Steingass said on the record?
Your Honor, my reading of Judge Steingass's decision, and you have her findings of fact and conclusions of law as an appendix to our trial brief, so I don't mean to substitute my judgment for yours. But my understanding is that Judge Steingass said the following things. Lynn's earning capacity has been permanently affected by the years that she's been out of the job market and the extent to which she has taken on virtually sole parenting responsibility for four children so that Paul could pursue his career unfettered. Yes, she's going back to school. Yes, she is going back into the job market. But even if she does the best that she can do, she is not going to be able to achieve the standard of living enjoyed during the marriage. And that's why I'm awarding indefinite term maintenance. Now, things are going to change, and I anticipate that there will be changes. I anticipate that she will complete her education and earn more. I anticipate that Paul will eventually have less and finally no child support obligation, so his ability to pay will increase. And when those things happen, we're going to have to redo the arithmetic and refigure what a reasonable maintenance amount would be. But this is not a case for limited term maintenance. This is a case where she has been permanently affected. She's been permanently damaged. And since 1990, when Judge Steingass made that decision, Lynn has continued to provide services to this family. She has continued to care for their children. She has continued to do what needs to be done for this family so that Paul can move around the country and pursue his employment possibilities unfettered.
It's basically your position here that the big mistake that Judge Fiedler made was that he terminated maintenance. He allowed it to continue, but for a limited period of time, and then it was terminated. And you're saying that's totally wrong because of what Judge Steingass said in 1990?
Yes.
And
because
do you have any authority that really is persuasive to the point that a second court looking at the issue of maintenance, cannot determine that there are substantial change in circumstances sufficient to now change that original order? Do any of our cases say that?
Of course, Your Honor, our cases say that the subsequent court can, with the showing of an appropriate substantial change in circumstance, modify a maintenance order. The point that I'm making here is that this court modified its maintenance order looking only at the changes that the divorce court anticipated and factored into her initial order, so that there wasn't anything unexpected about Lynn's finishing her education and earning more money. She was simply exercising the due diligence that Barr and other cases require her to exercise.
Well, if Judge Fiedler had said it's unjust and inequitable to allow maintenance to continue indefinitely, would that have been sufficient? Because that's what, as I heard you argue earlier, that's what you were telling us the standard was we should adopt.
I believe that that's correct. I believe that in any case where, on the record, a maintenance payer can show that it would be unjust or inequitable to continue the prior court's order of maintenance, a modification court has the authority to change the maintenance award. I don't believe that that standard was met in this case. I don't believe that any reasonable court on the record that we have here could find that it was unjust or inequitable to Paul to continue the maintenance amount. I believe that a mistake that the trial court made was by basing its decisions on factors that the original trial court had already factored into the indefinite maintenance determination, and by not paying appropriate attention to the factors that showed that Paul's situation had improved significantly since the time of the divorce. And the red light is on, so I think I've got to stop.
So, counsel, I do have one question now that I've... And,
yes, sir.
And I was referring particularly to the original divorce order that you were reciting. What does the language mean that this analysis, this is Judge Steingass's words, becomes outdated once your client earns in accordance with her capacity with completion of her education and once the child support figures change? What does that mean?
It means that the calculation as to the amount of maintenance needs to be changed, Your Honor. I don't believe it speaks to the term, because if it did, this judge in 1990 would have ordered limited term maintenance, and that's not what happened here.
Well, I see that, and I was going to say, and I'll ask opposing counsel, he obviously disagrees with this interpretation, and that language seems to me to leave open that question. So that's why you were filling in the blanks and saying what the court should do, but in reading that order, I just wanted to call that to your attention. So that's your meaning.
Your Honor, I believe that has to be read in the context of the court's finding that her earning capacity had been permanently negatively affected by her contributions to the marriage.
Well, the court also, in just continuing, said, well, she may make eventually $40,000. She's making substantially more than $40,000. Even in when you, and we went through the calculation with the modification court. But I think you've answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Roberson. Just to put it,
how does that sound?
Higher?
How does that sound?
All right. Right. We'll try that.
Okay.
Is he on?
Justice Abramson, members of the court, I am Attorney Stefan Bialke, and I represent Paul Baumgart. Our position is that you ought to affirm the trial court's decision as well as the Court of Appeals. Maintenance is not a permanent annuity. And when the recipient becomes self-supporting at a standard of living at or above marital standard of living, maintenance should terminate. That is what happened here. The comments about trial court dictating how much the petitioner should spend on any given item isn't in the record. It's an argument, and that's it. And I think some of the justices touched on this before. There's no restriction. The comments at page 187 of the transcript from the trial, which is R45, indicate that. Judge Feeler did not dictate that.
Counsel, what is the standard for a modification of maintenance?
Standard is, first, is there a threshold step? Was there a substantial change of circumstances? As indicated in the briefs and on the record, the parties stipulated to that. And the Court of Appeals went through the analysis, but the bottom line is we stipulated to that, that there was a substantial change of circumstances. The next question is that change sufficient or appropriate to modify or terminate maintenance?
Let me ask the question in a little different way. Your opposing counsel said that modification of maintenance requires more than just a substantial change in circumstance. It also requires a showing that it is unjust or inequitable to one of the parties to continue the original order.
I think the Court of Appeals in this case touched on that, this in a number of other cases too, but basically we have maintenance doctrines of support and fairness. The unjust or inequitable concept, so to speak, is within that fairness concept that each judge in each of these cases should be looking at, and I think that's what happened here. I think a big factor here is that when Judge Feeler had the hearing in 2001, he entered a finding that the petitioner was living comparable to that which existed during a marriage if she tightened her belt. Did Judge Feeler terminate it that day? No. He gave the petitioner 2 additional years, and I think that's a very strong example of the trial court's acknowledgement of the fairness concept.
So I just need to make sure I understand. So you are in agreement that modification of maintenance requires more than just a substantial change in circumstance. Modification of maintenance also requires the court to address the continued fairness of that initial order.
Yes, and I think the Court of Appeals hit upon this at length, and I think it's a matter of how we interpret it. We may have different opinions on what the ultimate is, but I think the petitioner wants the court to look at this issue standalone. In every case, all you have to do is say what's just or unjust.
Let me then just finish the circle in my mind. Then I take it you do not disagree, or more appropriately stated, that you agree with your opposing counsel that modification of maintenance requires more than just substantial change in circumstance. It also requires a finding that it is unjust or inequitable to hold the parties to the original order.
I think the concept has to be considered. A specific finding on that, I'm not so sure that that has to occur in every case. But within the fairness concept of the doctrines for maintenance, it is in there.
Is it that you are hesitating with my term, that the court has to make a finding? Are you in agreement that the court, after addressing whether or not there's a substantial change in circumstance, then has to address whether it is unjust or inequitable to hold the parties to the original order?
I think that's what the case law states already.
Well,
and it's
a two-prong test in order to make a modification of maintenance. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
And the substantial change in review was envisioned by the trial court. Finding of fact number 40 at the time of the original trial was Judge Steingast clearly indicated that, yes, the petitioner needs time to get on her feet, get her education, but we're going to review it. There is no restriction on the amount or the term. It's implied that both could be argued, and that's what happened here. The other counsel indicates, oh, no, that's just for the amount. You can't change maintenance. Is she stating to this court that there are no circumstances where this maintenance order should be changed? That's illogical. Once the court can determine, and I think use good discretion here, to find this lady was able to meet, be comparable to the standard of living during the marriage, the concept of fairness dictates then that maintenance should terminate, and Judge Fiedler gave her an additional 2 years.
Well, what were the substantial changes here in circumstances? Just tick them off. She's now making $40,000 instead of what? Smaller amount. Right.
Well, I think the biggest factor was that she obtained her education, which was the master's degree in special education, in 1994, which was long before the hearing in 2001. At the time of the divorce, she was earning $734 per month gross.
Right. Mm-hmm.
When we had the hearing in October of 2001, her income as a teacher was approximately $44,000. She had additional income, part-time work as a counselor at Briar Patch, $13,965, interest and dividend income of $3,000, $61,000. That is a substantial change of circumstance.
Okay, what about his? Don't we have to look at both sides of this equation?
Yes, and I believe that was pointed out in the Court of Appeals, too, where Mr. Baumgart, I believe, was at $93,000 and $105,000 when we had the review hearing. So that was the spread for him. And I would emphasize that there was testimony by the petitioner that she was receiving raises of a few thousand dollars per year just as a teacher. And if you make reasonable projections, by time the maintenance was terminated this last December 2003, she's probably $65,000 per year plus at that point. And if you look at the divorce judgment, what is the marital standard of living here? And counsel on the other side has never given the court a figure. She says, whatever I presented at the time of the review hearing is the standard of living during a marriage. No. What was it back when they had the trial in 1992?
And do you have to add inflation for the interim? Otherwise, you're decreasing your standard of living.
You can add inflation still comes out that she's far above what the standard was. And it was back in 1992, when you look at the findings of fact and what she commented about her budget and taking out the children, the standard of living, the marital standard of living for her alone is $3,000. And if you add on inflation, she's far above that, just with her teaching, let alone all the other income she has.
What about heftier recognition that they put in 19 years of marriage, and that's going to pay off for him in the future, and the fact that she's late in getting into the job market's going to hurt her, she doesn't have as much retirement income, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I believe that was factored into the original maintenance order as well as what Judge Fiedler did, but the Hefty case, when you look at it closely, is really an exception to the general rule. In that case, you had the president, I believe it was Blue Cross Blue Shield, had huge income, huge bonuses. And he said, well, it doesn't look fair. We've got this percentage order on maintenance. We're going to go further and say if there are marked fluctuations that are reasonably anticipated for the future, we're going to give more than just the marital standard of living, meaning more than what the budget was for the marital standard of living. You look at the Hefty case, and I would point you to page 135, where that states that that's a limited holding. And the Johnson 2 case that has been cited in the briefs at page 520 emphasized that Hefty had a set of unique facts, and it doesn't counter section 767.26, parent 6, which relates to the maintenance statute on the feasibility of being self-supporting at a standard of living reasonably comparable to that enjoyed during the marriage.
Counsel, I want to focus on reasonably comparable to that enjoyed during the marriage, because I smiled when I read page 134 of the Hefty decision. You just referenced page 135, but former Chief Justice Day wrote this opinion, and he put in bold letters in 134, page 134, that the standard is essentially, like you say, reasonably comparable to that enjoyed during the marriage, and then in bold letters, and could anticipate enjoying if they were to stay married, citing the LaRocque case, emphasis added, of course. Is that a correct statement of the law, and is LaRocque a correct statement of the law that's cited at 36?
Under certain sets of facts, and I think the Hefty decision, when read in full, will state that. It was an unusual fact situation there. It wasn't an average couple getting divorced with a maintenance issue. It was the man with huge income, huge projected income increases in the future. Yes, that's the law, but that was pointed out by the Court of Appeals, too, that the petitioner never developed this, in fact, never argued that at the trial court level. The briefs were the first time this came up. Judge Feeler never had an opportunity to even think about that because that wasn't advanced by the petitioner.
Well, I just want to, my interest in part is to make sure I have clear all of the legal standards, and that's one of the areas of inquiry that I focused on with regard to my initial questions of you, counsel. And then this is the next. You would put a caveat on the Hefty opinion and the LaRocque opinion. Well, you know, LaRocque, with all, let me say this, the party in LaRocque was not Hefty. I mean, that... and yet the same premise is apparently found in LaRocque. So how can you say it's only if you're the head of a corporation? Because, of course, we know Judge LaRocque at $60,000 a year was not the head of a large corporation.
I think what I said was you have to look at the facts, and one of the big facts was the fact that we had a gentleman that was the president of an insurance company in Hefty. But I think when you look at that case, goes into the length of the marriage, the sacrifices, the earning abilities of the parties, projected income of the parties. Again, that goes to all the statutory factors that a judge should be looking at an initial maintenance determination. And that is an exception when you look at Johnson 2 at the site I referenced at page 520 and other cases. They don't go in every case and say, we're going to anticipate what Mr. Black or Mr. Jones is going to make 10 years down the road. Okay, they say we're going to review it. And I think that's what this court did initially, projected some review, and that happens in most cases, quite frankly.
Did the Hefty court miscite the LaRocque court for that premise? The premise on page 134 cites the LaRocque court for that premise. And I think, at least in my mind, in fairness, I cannot put the parties in the LaRocque situation in the kind of unique case category that you say Hefty is in. And yet, so is this opinion misquoting LaRocque for that premise? Because apparently it applied in LaRocque also, unless the site is wrong.
Generally speaking, I don't think so. But what I'm saying is there are unique fact situations where a court will go beyond what the usual general rule is. What was the marital standard of living? Have we exceeded that or not?
Let me clarify. One, same standard on modification, whether it's a stipulation or a non-stipulated.
Oh, I think the standards are the same, and I think the Court of Appeals stated that. The one reference, and I believe, was in the petitioner's brief. I don't know if you can even read that into what happened in this case in the Court of Appeals, because there really wasn't.
You agree with the petitioner about that. You agree that the modifying court can't disregard or modify the original court's findings of fact?
I agreed before, and as I said, it's a matter of how we interpret it.
All right. Now let's get to, for the moment, that the wife's support now for adult children. Do you think there is a blanket rule that the modifying court should not consider that kind of support for adult education in determining the needs of the wife here?
If you're talking about whether or not we should increase or decrease or terminate maintenance, my answer is yes. As stated in the Dahlke case and other cases, the fact that somebody is applying a portion of their budget for college, that's her choice.
Okay, so that's just, if we were looking at her budget, that $900 would be out of that budget. That is not a valid expense to be considered. If she wants to pay the $900, she got to take it out of her other parts of the budget or savings or something.
That's correct. And I think my biggest point is if the law is going to change in this area, the legislature ought to change it. If you want my client and other payors to come into court and say, I can't pay my ex-wife because I'm spending all this on the college expenses, that would be the best.
He's paying it to her, and your position then is that it's an indirect payment for the child's education, the adult child's education.
Correct, but I want to emphasize, if you open this door, as requested by the petitioner, you're opening the door for the payors as well as the payees, and I believe that the payees will be negatively impacted because most of the people in families that are separated and there's a divorce, the payor has the money. He's probably the most likely one to be spending it on college, and I don't think we want to entertain a change in the law that says, okay, all you people can come back and fight about this stuff.
But he hasn't offered to do that, has he? He's not offered to take up the $900 a month for the adult child.
Well, not specifically, but they were both doing things for their college kids.
No, but he is not incurring that expense, as I read the record here.
I'm not sure exactly what was in his budget for that expense he was contributing. I don't think it was the $900.
Okay, but you're not saying she's double billing, that he's paying it and she's charging him in effect?
Not necessarily.
Okay. So it's not even discretionary with the trial court as to considering this $900. It's just out as far as you're concerned.
Is it
out in every case, or is it in this case because they never considered the education of the child, the adult, and when they did consider it, they couldn't reach an agreement about a college fund?
This was pointed out by the Court of Appeals. We didn't have a specific agreement.
No, but is
that's an exception. Then I would say that would be an exception.
Specific agreement for a trust fund or a specific agreement for a general agreement that says, and we will continue our children's education as long as they need it, and it seems reasonable.
If you keep a general, look out. What I'm saying is $500 a month, we're going to contribute until our youngest child's age 18.
That's a specific agreement.
That's an exception to what I'm saying. Yes.
So it's not even discretionary with the trial court. It's out because the legislative policy is different. That's your position.
That's my position, because otherwise you're going to get into fights about who pays, who decides, are we sending the kids to Harvard, are we going to MATC, what?
Okay, well then how do we, if we knock out an educational expense or a support expense for an adult child, then how do we treat aviation and clothing of $500 a month? Does the court knock that out too?
Well, it depends upon which focus is it and what your standards are. If there is an achievement of the marital standard of living.
If there is what?
An achievement of the marital standard of living, that really isn't all that relevant, quite frankly. And
he can make a million and she could be down to 60,000, 66,000, and you could still put her on limited maintenance.
Depends upon the facts of the case, Your Honor.
But of course.
Yeah,
but your position is she's already maintained the marital status. Therefore, it doesn't matter what he makes and what he spends.
Basically, that's what I'm saying.
That's
once she's attained that marital standard of living, I think that's the law, Your Honor.
Well,
Okay, what's the marital status of living? How do you calculate it? What she made plus inflation? What she made plus inflation, looking at any additional expenses she's incurred or is incurring? Like if she's ill or potentially will need medical care, which we all do.
That's a statutory factor that would be considered in how maintenance would be reviewed if it's a health issue.
Sorry.
Let's take the facts of Hefty and divide or change them a bit. Let's put the concept of a Hefty type case. That is, I forget how many kids they had, maybe they had a number of kids. And let's say it's a long-term marriage. Let's say they got married and they're in their early 20s, and now it's 50, and so it's 30 years marriage. And she, by and large, has raised the kids, and she has a college degree in psychology. And at age 50, he's still, he's not quite made it to the upper echelons of a company in my hypothetical. Maybe he's making $100,000. They get and she's making, you know, less than $15,000 part-time work. So that's at age 50. And by age 60, just like actually Hefty, he had a big jump in income. He went from like 80 or 90,000 to 3 years later, 400,000. You put base, and you know, he had a big jump. Okay,
right.
So that kind of a jump, you know, making 80 or 100,000, but 4 years later, you're making 600,000. Let's say you moved up a bit, the company went public. And under your hypothetical, as long or under this hypothetical, your response would be that although they've been married 30 years, that she really wasn't in the job market, that she raised the kids, that it's frozen at the time of the divorce. And as long as she can reach, you know, get a job and get a master's degree and make, oh, let's say $30,000, because if you had $100,000, let's say they're at a 50% bracket, you know, I mean, $30,000 would work out just fine because she wouldn't be able, after you pay taxes, she wouldn't be making much more. So she isn't to enjoy any of that benefit of the increase after they've been divorced?
No, I'm not saying that. I think you have to look at the total facts of each case, and when you look at the facts in the Hefty case, the marital standard of living was to be determined very high, and that's how the award was structured for the about-to-be ex-wife in that case. And that came into play in how they defined the marital standard. It was reasonably anticipated that this gentleman would rise the ladder very fast with huge amounts of money, and it would fluctuate too. But I'm emphasizing how much these maintenance cases are fact-driven and they're dependent upon the discretion of the trial court. And I don't think in this case the petitioner has proven to the court at all that there was an erroneous exercise of discretion here. There were a lot of facts that had to be interpreted.
Could I ask again, I thought your analysis on change in or modification in maintenance. First, a threshold substantial change in circumstances, and then a change in circumstances where it is sufficient or appropriate to modify or terminate maintenance. Could you flesh out once again what you take into account in sufficient or appropriate?
Well, I think we have to look at all the statutory factors under the maintenance statute.
767.26.
Correct. And one of the major emphasis is the marital standard of living. And you focus on that one, man. when you're in a review situation years after a divorce situation. I think when you have a trial court looking at the maintenance factors, it's probably more scrutiny. They look closer at each and every factor, but when you have review, a lot of times there are only a few factors in that review that really are relevant or pertinent for what's being considered.
And the unjust or inequitable, where does that come in?
I believe the case law has indicated, and I'm emphasizing that that's within the concept of the fairness doctrine. We have the support doctrine, fairness doctrine for maintenance, and that concept is really within that fairness concept. And I mean, the Court of Appeals in this case made it a point saying, well, in all cases, really, there's an umbrella of fairness, and that's true. And there is no formula for fairness. None of us here today can pick out an exact formula for that. It's impossible, and that's why it's important for the trial court to have discretion.
In LaRock, the opinion notes that in determining maintenance, the trial court considered that Mr. LaRock was going to help pay for education for his adult children and gave him credit for that in the sense of when they parceled out the income, but was not willing to give her credit for expenses incurred when the children lived with her, adult children lived with her, and that was viewed as bad. Now, was LaRock before a change in the statute relating to adult children education?
I don't believe so, but I'm not sure exactly what the wording was in LaRock and how that issue was commented on, but I think the case law that we've had for years and years has really emphasized child support is limited by statute.
We find it difficult to understand why, in awarding maintenance, the circuit court credited LaRock's payment of college expenses for adult children, particularly when such payment is unstipulated and as yet unrealized, but did not consider the expenses of Mrs. LaRock incurred by having adult children live with her. So then the court goes on and says that it erroneously applied the statutory factors. So I'm merely suggesting that depending on the timing, and I did not look that up, at least in LaRock, the expenses for the adult children were considered in setting maintenance.
To what extent? I don't know.
Ultimately, it was sent back, so
correct.
That would not have been a determination of this court. And in Hefty, the Hefty Court, written by Day, precisely quoted correctly the LaRock Court, which said that according to this court's decision, LaRock, it's proper to consider lifestyle that the parties could anticipate enjoying if they stayed married. They don't, and then it says not unexpected increase. Like the lottery, I guess, would be that. But that since they worked together, they would expect an increase in compensation right. over the years. So Hefty is an unusual case, but the principle of law appears in LaRock, which is not an unusual case.
I agree.
So what do you want us to do? Just affirm? How do you want us to write the opinion so it's... That's as much
well,
as
I think the Court of Appeals set forth a fairly logical analysis of the issues, and I think you ought to reaffirm along those lines. I really do.
What should we do with footnote one?
Maintenance is not the paragon of clarity. That, I believe, is in that footnote or another one, because the facts of each case is different. Okay? And I don't think it's possible for this court, any court, trial court, appellate court, to set down an exact formula on maintenance.
But it is our job to set down what are the standards and the rules and the guidelines, and that should be clear.
Correct. And I believe the standards that are set out in the Court of Appeals decision did that. My warning light's on for a couple minutes.
You have a few minutes. Justice Prosser has a question.
Why is it unfair or inequitable to maintain the present maintenance payment or the former maintenance payment?
Well, you have to look at what the marital standard of living was. The fairness concept applies to both sides, not just one. How many years has Mr. Baumgart been paying substantial child support and also maintenance? I believe it's 11-plus years on a 19-year marriage. And Judge Fiedler commented, and I got a red light here, that they were married young and divorced fairly young. It's different than if you were divorced when you're 60.
Fairness, the unjust or inequitable, is tied. It's not just free-floating. It's tied to one of those factors in 7726, or what?
Well, it's within the fairness doctrine and how you interpret what the facts of that case would be. And there is no formula for defining what's unjust or unfair because it's so fact-driven. Each case, really.
Counsel, just, I asked opposing counsel, when just Judge Steingass rendered her opinion, she said that, and I quoted, that the analysis that she used becomes outdated once she, being the wife, earns in accordance with her capacity with completion of her education and once the child support figures change. Now, do you think that time has come? I'm talking about, is that what?
That's what happened here.
Yeah, that's what happened.
Yes, that's right.
That's. I could only read it that obviously a new analysis would be needed or could be used once she earns in accordance with her capacity and completed her education and once the child support figures changed. Now, right now, I assume that there is no child support being paid now, right?
Correct. June of 2003 was the last payment for child support, yes.
Chief, may I just... Mm-hmm.
With regard to Judge Steingass's order, it says on page 3, the last line, it's paragraph 15, whether support from bonuses should be placed in a college fund. She's listing issues that are yet to be decided. And then, so that's attorney's fees is another contribution, attorney's fees, but and whether support from bonuses should be placed in a college fund. Then later on, when there is the conclusions of law and judgment, number 5, it's on page 10. Apparently, the judge made a decision, and the decision was that the payment from bonuses should not be made or placed in a separate fund, but rather the husband shall pay directly to Ms. Baumgart 29% of any gross bonus received by him within 48 hours after its receipt. That sum need not be placed in any college fund because Ms. Baumgart, as the parent receiving child support, is entitled to exercise discretion over how the money is spent, and she needs the money for necessary living expenses. An argument is advanced that when you read those two things together, that the parties apparently agreed that there would be support for children, and the only issue was whether that should be paid into a separate fund or paid directly to her. Now, the argument is then if the parties contemplated money from the father to be paid to the mother, disagreed on whether or not they had to be placed in a separate fund, with that agreement, how does it now come into play that none of her living expense, none of her expenses can be attributed to college for the kids?
The decision by Judge Steingast clearly indicated there wasn't enough money to go around, whether it's contribution on attorney's fees, but the basic child support in the maintenance order left both parties short. They didn't have the luxury of college funding.
Is it a fair interpretation that of this, that the parties intended that there be funds for college? I'm asking if this is fair, that the parties, my interpretation is fair. The parties intended that there be funds for college. They disagreed whether or not there should be a separate fund. The court ordered that there not be a separate fund, but that in any event that didn't change that the parties' agreement there should be funds for college. Blah, 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 blah. Do you agree with that? Is that a fair statement that I made, or do you disagree with? Accurate, rather, not fair.
I guess I qualified a little bit, but I think that topic came up, obviously, but there wasn't enough money to go around. They could just barely pay for the maintenance and the child support, and they both were still short at that point. And even if they had an agreement, are we talking $10 a month? Are we talking $5,000 a month? It's really indefinite. It's impossible to decide on.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for your consideration.
Sir? Roberson?
So is the microphone okay?
So far.
All right. Thank you. It has been conceded that the appropriate standard here is whether continuation of the initial trial course award of indefinite term maintenance is unfair or inequitable to Paul. There is no way on the record that we have in this case that any reasonable court could conclude that he has met that burden. All of the factors in the LaRocque case apply here, and more. Because in LaRocque, the children were all of age at the time of the initial divorce trial. And in this case, we had minor children who continued to be at home. There continued to be minor children for whom Ms. Rhody Giovanni was responsible up to and including and through the modification hearing. As opposing counsel mentioned, the youngest child didn't turn 18 until just this past summer. So Ms. Rhody Giovanni continued to contribute to Paul's earning capacity by being the virtually sole parent for four children after the divorce, at the same time that she was going to school and working part-time. She's put in 29 years worth of parenting that has allowed Mr. Baumgart to pursue his career unfettered by family responsibilities. And in fairness, the court needs to consider that. I'd like to talk a little bit, if I could, about this sticky issue of the marital standard of living. Opposing counsel suggests that what this court must do is to look at the standard of living found by the trial court initially back in 1990 to subtract out Ms. Rhody Giovanni's listed expenses for the children, and then to apply the cost of living multiplier to come up with her standard of living today. You might want to check my arithmetic, but when I did this, I came up with a net income that she needed to meet her budget of $3,880 per month. She does not meet that, even working two jobs. She is over $500 a month short, working two jobs.
That's net.
Net.
Not gross.
Net. I do not believe that the marital standard of living requires her, at age 50 plus, still having responsibilities to children, even though they are technically adults. I don't think the marital standard of living requires her to work two jobs. If you look at her net income from one job and compare that net income from one job to opposing counsel's view of her budget, she is still significantly short. Her net income from one job is $2,114 net per month from her school district job. Compare that to the $3,880 budget.
What about his net?
The changes in circumstances that Mr. Baumgart has experienced have been really twofold. One is that his income has also increased from $7,750 gross to $8,905 gross at the time of the modification hearing. At the modification hearing, his net was $5,092, but he was taking out nearly $900 a month in a voluntary retirement contribution, which could theoretically be added back in to determine what the actual dollars available to him on a monthly basis are. And in addition, he's now paying no child support, which is a net increase to him of almost $2,000 a month. So, yes, Lynn's income has increased, but Paul's income has increased also, and because he's not paying child support, the income he has available has increased even further. Moreover, he has remarried and is sharing living expenses with another person, reducing his budgetary needs and increasing the discretionary income that he has. But my point here is that even if you use opposing counsel's very restrictive view of looking at the marital standard of living, and even if you subtract out the expenses for the adult children, there is no way that Ms. Rhody Giovanni comes even close to meeting that budget set back in 1990 and adjusted for cost of living increases. I would further say that her budget that she submitted at the time of the trial was undisputed. And so that is the budget that the court should be looking at. If that happens, the discrepancies are even greater. And I'm out of time, so I've got to stop. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Roberson. Thank you, Mr. Brown, for your arguments in this case, which is important not only to the parties but to many others in the state. And that ends our argument in this case. But before I do, I want to recognize a colleague, Judge Constance from Racine. And I gather that's your son. If not, he looks like you. Good. Well, welcome to you both. That concludes our hearing for this afternoon in Remarriage of Linda Rhody Giovanni versus Paul Albert Baumgart. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45. The court will meet in the conference room. Can't make it a little earlier. Thank you. That's good seeing you. What does your son do?
He's a freshman at the University of Iowa. So he's just finishing up school break.
Oh, and
I thought my father took me to some art. I enjoy this. He's not interested in being a lawyer yet.
Well, you don't know.
You never know.
I am Shirley Abrahamson. It's good seeing you. Thanks for coming.
Shut me up the door. Okay.